Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again. We're going to have a conversation this hour with Madison Smart Bell. He's written another novel called Devil's Dream. He's been coming on the show ever since, I think, All Souls Rising, Match of the Crossroads, and The Stone That the Builder Refused, which was his trilogy about Haiti, which was just incredible. And he's been on the show many times for his other books as well. And he's back once again. And Madison, welcome. Good to see you, brother.
Well, it's nice to be here. I'm glad I finally found my way to your new and partially disclosed location.
Hiding out here.
Nice place to hide.
It's a good place to hide. I love it down here. This latest novel is a novel about Nathan Bedford Forrest, who many of us who know history associate with the founding of the Klan, that we'll talk a bit about that later, and the myth that I think Madison wanted to debunk about that. But the first thing I have to say to you is, you just wrote this novel, which I will say up front that I loved, and you wrote it about Nathan Bedford Forrest, a man who I remember from my history books as the man who slaughtered hundreds if not thousands of black soldiers at the Battle of Fort Pillow, and who was associated with a Klan who I reviled at every step of the turn of my life. And if I was in the Civil War, I'd have been on the other side shooting a musket at him, trying to take him down.
Undoubtedly. Many people were. None of them could ever do it.
So how did you write a book to make me empathetic and actually find Nathan Bedford Forrest an appealing, interesting, fascinating character?
Well, I think he, in fact, was enough of an appealing and fascinating and charismatic character to make people overcome their very serious and well-justified objections to him during his life. He had a remarkable leadership ability that made people want to follow him, whether they liked him or not. And even in the Confederacy, most people started out not liking him if they hadn't met him and only sort of knew his resume, because he was, for two reasons, he was not a very well-educated person. He was a frontiersman. He had, unlike most of the officer cadre on both sides of the Civil War, he had not been to the military academy.
He was not a West Pointer.
And so that was one thing. He was not a gentleman soldier like most of them were, or any kind of gentleman other than a natural one, maybe. And the other thing, perhaps even worse, was he'd been a slave trader before the war, and that was socially unacceptable to everybody who bought slaves, owned slaves, had their work done by slaves, and consumed their products. Oddly enough, but there we are.
But tell me, though, what consumed you about how you began this story before we talk about the novel. I mean, I know when we spent our time talking about your trilogy on Haiti that you wrote this incredible story and in the biography of Toussaint Louverture and about the slaves rebelling against slavery and fighting for their freedom and liberation. And then you turned to Nathaniel Bedford Forrest, a slave owner and runner. So tell me.
Well, I have that. From the beginning, I felt that Forrest and Toussaint Louverture had some points in common that are, oddly enough, that they were both self-made men. They were both superb horsemen. They could control and dominate men and animals very effectively. They were great leaders who moved people to follow them, and they were great and self-taught military leaders. So I felt that they would have understood each other for mm-hmm. those things that they shared, even though they wouldn't have agreed on much else, probably. I have a low boredom threshold. I don't like to repeat myself. this was, in a way, the most completely different thing I could think of to do at the time. And at the time that I started thinking about it, there was a subtly expressed interest on the part of my publisher that I write a Civil War novel. And I think they would have liked it a lot if I could have written something like Coal Mountain, but unfortunately I just don't think I can do that. I'm sorry. I would solve a lot of financial problems for me if I could. instead I wrote this, but I went toward Forrest, because he's a contrary enough figure that I felt like I could write a novel about him, which would inevitably be a Civil War novel, but would not fall into the usual cliches. If he's at the center of it, it's not going to be Cold Mountain, and it's not going to be Gone with the Wind. Which I'd always been interested in the guy. They have different stuff in the history books I read when I was growing up down south.
Because you grew up in Tennessee,
absolutely. And Forrest was in the history books, but they didn't say anything about him being in the Klan. A Klan really wasn't in our history books at all,
right?
And they didn't say anything about Fort Pillow either. They talked about him as this, heroic figure who, and these things are also true, by the mm-hmm, way. I mean, mm-hmm, that what mm-hmm. you said is true. There's a quibble in detail about the Klan that we should make time for. But
no, we will.
But yeah, he was the head of the Klan. He didn't found it, but he was the head of it. And there's a difference between that Klan and the ones we got later that you personally struggle against. And in fact, I have too. But in any case, he was held up as this hero, and he was a very heroic figure, because he was able to get, in the South as they were losing, which was basically most of the time, he basically never lost any engagements, and he had this indomitable will to succeed, and he took good care of his people. Which was very, very important to soldiers, particularly late in the war when, part of the thing they're thinking about is, am I going to have shoes? Am I going to have food? Where's a command where if I get killed, I at least won't get killed for nothing, and they'll feed me. And Forrest did all those things. And they loved him for that.
You, if I remember right from conversations long ago, not in the studio. Part of your family is from Mississippi, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, talk about that. And is there a connection between that and what you know about Forrest?
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, Forrest was actually born in Middle Tennessee, not far from where I was from. But as a child, really, his father died. They lost their land there, and they moved to North Mississippi, which was then the frontier. Where he was born was the frontier at the time that he was born there.
Mm-hmm.
And he made some money and success, in two ways. Livestock trading, which then sort of morphed into slave trading, which was more profitable, was the way that he made money. And he acquired a somewhat useful reputation, but yet he had an extraordinary talent for violence. And he killed a bunch of men who had attacked him and his uncle, and in fact killed his uncle. These were assassins, basically, in a little muddy crossroads called Hernando, Mississippi. And the interesting detail of this is in those days, guns, had one or two barrels, maybe. Forrest used up his ammunition, and he was outnumbered. And a sympathetic bystander threw him a knife, which he caught and used to kill the rest of these guys. And this impressed everyone in more than one way. I think people were kind of horrified by it, but at the same time, he was appointed constable of Hernando because nobody wanted to screw with him. And sort of in that way, as somebody that people were appalled by, horrified by, and yet somehow respected for his ability to for his mastery of people, and he was pretty good with crowds. He could single-handedly face down angry and violent mobs. He did that a couple of times on the streets of Memphis where he settled, and he became an alderman in Memphis mm-hmm. on the strength of this, although he wasn't in a socially respectable profession by any means, and his manners were extremely rough.
What really kind of grabs me is this whole question of honor, the way you live your life, and how you can find respect in that despite the rest of what his life was, whether it was selling slaves or helping destroy Reconstruction or whatever it was. The way he led his life on another level with honor must have attracted you and pulled you into him, And then you must have wrestled with those contradictions.
I do not think that Forrest had the same idea of honor that his peers and superiors in the Confederate or Union military did, which was kind of sentimental, really, in a way. It was, there was a chivalric idea of honor and glory that dominated the thinking of a lot of the officers in the Civil War, and I think probably the foot soldiers, the idea of noble causes and how sweet and becoming it is to butcher the Wilfred Owen poem to die for your country, that sort of thing. I don't think Forrest was interested in that kind of thing at all, that style of honor. I think what to him, and he was in his way a very honorable man, honor was making good on responsibility to your family and your people. And in my mind, in the book, there's some puns on the idea of ownership, where owning means, you know, possession and, you know, purchase and possession in the sense of objects and chattels and slaves. And it also means owning up to your relationships and responsibilities. And that I think was honor for Forrest, that he was somebody whose command was a kind of patriarchy that included all sorts of people, and that he felt he was fighting for all of their survival in the terms that he understood, which are in some ways deeply wrong terms, but he believed in them. And that's where I think the potency of his honor comes from.
Now, we're talking with Madison Smart Bell about his latest novel, Devil's Dream, which is a novel about Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was an incredible figure in American history, a Confederate general, a slave owner, a slave runner, a man who was associated with the Klan after the war. And Madison takes us on a different kind of tour with him that talks about that, but is also very revealing and moving. The way you open one of the earliest scenes in the book, where he meets Marianne and helps his carriage, who becomes his wife, and pushes the carriage out of the mud in this confrontation with those men, it's like at that moment you were setting up for us who this guy was and how he looked at life.
Well, that little scene is true. Most of the details of that were true. He, when he was a young man in Hernando making a living in the livestock trade at that point, he saw a young woman named Marianne Montgomery who was of a higher social class than he, and who he probably would never have met. She, however, was a little bit down on her luck because her father had died and she had moved in with an uncle in a place that was between Memphis and Hernando. And she probably had better social prospects for her marriage than a guy like Forrest. But Forrest happened to run into her conveyance stuck in a stream. She is with her mother in this thing, and the driver is trying to get it out, which he can't do. And two of her admirers, boyfriends, suitors, are sitting on the bank watching this because they don't want to get their clothes dirty. all this is so Forrest, who was knew an opportunity when he saw one, got off his horse and waded out into the mud and helped the slave driver, you know, push it out. He carried the women to shore to make it lighter, blah blah blah. And then he ran the suitors off. He said, you people are beneath contempt, and much less polite terminology than that. Get out of my sight or I will do you physical harm.
I wish I could read what you wrote here because I can't use this language on the
air.
You
can't put it on the air. But Forrest was a very self-controlled person. He did not drink. He did not use tobacco. He had a weakness for gambling, though, and he could not control his cursing, which was apparently very colorful.
You have it very colorfully written here, I would add.
I did the best I could, but I feel like it was never quite good enough. But in any case, and then he turns to her mother and says, I would like to, you know, call on your daughter. And how thrilled her mother was about that, we don't know. But in the end, and this is also true supposedly, it's in the books and biographies, that his courtship pitch to Marianne, who was, if you go with a guy like those guys who are standing on the bank, when your ox is in the ditch, they're going to leave it there. But if you go with me, I will get you out of situations like that. And I think, that was a metaphor for the fact that he was a very energetic comer, which in fact she was. And I think she was attracted to that. Beyond the practical, I think there must have been a tremendous sort of exciting energy in him as a young man that she was drawn to.
So the language in this book, the way you have him speaking, it feels real. The way you have the slave speaking feels real. I mean, talk about what you did. 'Cause I know that you're like you approach novels like an actor approaches a part.
I hear them. I don't see them.
Right.
So, I don't see them first. It's a lot about sound for me primarily. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with this in terms of the contrast, exaggerated contrasts in language and speech. Forrest was very rough and plain spoken, and I don't know if I really exaggerated that much. I took his voice from the voice of rural white people I worked with, around Middle Tennessee growing up, and I think it's pretty close. I mean, it's the same
region. Where was Middle Tennessee, just a digression?
It's the area around Nashville.
That's what I thought. Right.
The people, I grew up on a farm in that part of the world, and I went to private schools in Nashville, but because it was a working farm, I spent a lot of time when I was not in school with rural black people and rural white people, each of whom had a very kind of particular way of talking.
Mm-hmm.
So basically my slave speech is drawn
in the novel.
The novel is very dependent on the black people I grew up with in the rural South, and the Forrest speech is very much like that of white people in the same situation. You can still hear it. You can still hear something like that in conversation with Steve Earle, for example,
the blues player.
And the Drive By Truckers, a band I love. The interesting thing about them, and I think that it connects to. With them, it was like cognitive dissonance at first because I love the music, but that's just one thing. But they also talk and do interviews, and I've heard some. I said, these guys are really smart and well-educated, in fact. And I grew up, in a reflexive way, not connecting that speech style to either education or intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that's part of the game and of Forrest, is that he has this kind of abrasive speech manner, and whereas, and this is what's kind of exaggerated, all the other white people around them and then the fantastical Haitian characters speak very correctly by comparison. And so there's this big contrast, and yet, he's the person who's rhetorically driving everything.
Right. Obviously, he drives the novel. And so you hear these, it's interesting what you said, you hear these voices more than see them, and you play these conversations out in your head.
To be honest, with this story, that was one of the things that attracted me to it in the first place, because there were there are these hilarious contrasts between what Forrest actually said or would have said and the way he would have said it, and a lot of his official communications, many of which were written by a close friend and aide of his called Charles Anderson, who knew how to write a flowery mm-hmm. letter when that's what needed to be done. And I thought, this will be fun to play around with these things, because some of the texts are there.
Now, you open the novel with Henri cutting through this forest and trying to get from wherever he was trying to get to the next place, and his Haitian character. You have to have a Haitian character in here.
Well, I'll tell you what, I didn't make that up. It's I was told that story by a guy who would now be in his 90s. I mean, I think he is in his 90s.
Uh-huh.
Interesting sort of maverick lawyer in Nashville who had read the Haitian material
Your books.
He'd read some of them anyway, and we got talking about this and that, and he said, "Did you know that Forrest's personal bodyguard was all black men?" Immediately was quite interested.
And that really was true?
No.
Oh, okay.
and commanded by a son of Toussaint Louverture. And I thought, that sure is interesting.
A little bit of a time difference there, wasn't it?
At the time, Toussaint did have some illegitimate children that remained in Haiti, but they all would have been over 60 at the time of the Civil War. But on the other hand, sort of filiation in Haitian culture doesn't have to be that biological. So, I wanted that to be true in some way. I mean, just the all black bodyguard would have been great, but no, I can't find any trace. Forrest's escort, which was a sort of lightning fighting force, among other things, more than he didn't really require a bodyguard in the sense that other people might, they were in size maybe from 25 to 125 people. I think apparently there is some trace of a couple of black guys in that group, but it wasn't like the inner ring around Forrest was black people. Most of the black people who went to war with Forrest were Teamsters, non-combatants. He did make good on its promise to free those people after Chickamauga.
Talking about Chickamauga, there's a great line early on in your book, so we're not giving away too much as people read it, with Henri. when Henri is describing, I think they're in a battle, we're coming through it, with the Federals. You call the Union soldiers the Federals in this book, right?
Well, and later on they get to be Yankees, as they're disliked more, but...
Federals is how you begin. You start out.
Federals is maybe a little bit more polite.
But there's a great line here on the read. The Haitian says, "I was killed at Chickamauga." Henry thought. Henri thought to say, but it occurred to him that Chickamauga hadn't happened yet. I love that. That was one of my.
Well, there's this whole thing going on, and this I did. This was very convenient for me in being able to do some borrowings from Haitian culture, where dead people are considered to still be there with you, just invisibly. And again, I distorted this a little bit from the way it really is in Haiti. But the first reason for my doing that is my publisher bought this book on a proposal. Only time I've ever done this. I had four chapters and
same
a little bit of
as
description.
Before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dan Frank at Pantheon Books said to me on the phone, "I like this. There's one thing I would like you to consider, and that is it would be nice if it wasn't over 400 pages long." And I thought that was, you know what? That's a really good idea. on the other hand, I wrote a little bit. I see it happening, what happened to me with All Souls Rising, where I started to write one book and ended up, I put the calipers on it after 100 pages and realized, that I have one 2,000 page book and I'm dead, or it has to be more. So no, I'm not doing that this time. So I wrote everything out of order. I just wrote the good parts first, basically. Uh-huh. In fact, then there are nothing but good parts, because the sort of mundane tissue that normally connects episodes
and novels
together,
it's
not there.
That's right.
And then Henri, the fact that Henri is killed midway through the action but remains present as observer and witness and point of view character became a sort of transmission, like in a car, that allowed me to move around among these episodes in a non-chronological order. When I turned the book in, I didn't really think this had worked very well. But now when I see people, but fortunately the editors liked it, which I didn't
That's
think
good.
That they would. I thought, oh boy, I'm going to be working on this for another 18 months probably, and I'm going to hate it because I don't like to rewrite. I'm lazy in that way. But but instead, it worked on them, and I see that it actually does work on readers in the way that I hoped that it would. So that's been very cheering.
Well, it's very different than some of your other work, and I
In a curious way, I think because those you keep getting these battle scenes and that are sort of iconic and yet, you know, full of action detail, it is against my expectations somehow satisfying to readers who like to read Civil War action stories. I didn't really think that was going to work so well on that audience, but somehow it does because it keeps giving you that.
We're talking with Madison Smart Bell. His latest novel, Devil's Dream, is the story, a fictional story of Nathan Bedford Forrest, one of the great Confederate heroes, who was somebody that I was not born to like, but this book draws you into his life in a way you're not going to expect. And we'll be right back with more with Madison Smart Bell. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're here with Madison Smart Bell. We're talking about Devil's Dream, his latest novel, a novel about Nathan Bedford Forrest. There is a part in this book where Nathan Bedford Forrest, at the beginning of the Civil War, I think it was the beginning, I forget the year, but during the Civil War, and he's going to go fight for the Confederacy, but he goes to the slave quarters on his plantation, and he addresses his slaves. Well, first I'll let you read it, then I'm going to ask you some questions about it.
All right, let me read a little bit of this. This is something that actually did happen.
I was going to ask you that. This really did happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I had to invent a dialogue, but the basic outline of the event is true. He offered to slaves, not that he was trading in, but slaves that were working on a plantation that he owned, to come with him to war on the promise of freedom if the Confederates won. And he actually freed most of these people after the Battle of Chickamauga when he had figured out that the Confederates were probably not going to win. So here's a little bit of that scene, which, as I imagine that, slaves had straightened from the work and were shading their eyes to look at him, but they seemed uncertain if they should come. The day in the field had barely got started. Forrest turned, looked over his shoulder. A big iron bell stood on a post left of another gate. He flipped up his shirt tail and drew a pistol. Bracing right hand over left wrist, he took aim quickly and pressed the trigger. When the bell sounded, the slaves dropped their tools and came running. When they'd all gathered round, he took off his hat. "It's the war coming, sure enough," he announced. "I know y'all bound to have been hearing that talk. Well, now I mean to tell you the truth on it. Yankees are fixing to come down from the north. They aim to kill all they can and take what we got." He looked from one black face to another. Some looked worried, others unreadable. Men's eyes shaded by fraying straw brims. Women's heads bound in plain or checked cloth. He told off their names under his breath, his lips just barely moving. But for a couple, he could call their names true. "The war's against slavery, that's what they claim. If the Yankees whoop it, they'll set y'all free." "That's right, you heard me right. They ain't studying on what's to be done with you after that, but they aim to set the lot of y'all free." "I've joined up already to fight for the South," he told them. "Y'all, most of you know me for quite some time. Have you ever seen me to take a whipping?" And then there's this little thing that I don't really like where in italics there's this group murmur that to the effect that, no, they've never seen him take a whipping. Mm-hmm. I should have fixed that before I published the book. and then Forrest resumes, "Well, then, if the South wants it, we'll still have slavery in this country, and that's the side I'm fighting for. I'll tell you that straight out and no doubt about it. I don't mean to have nobody waltz in from somewhere else and start in and tell me what to do and not do. Forrest could feel the blood beating hard in his temples now. He stopped a minute and fanned himself with the hat. Now here's what I come down to say to you. War ain't just a coming, it's done already started. I aim to fight for the side I just said. That's all there is to it. But any man among you wants to fight alongside of me when the war once gets over with, I will set that man free. And then there's a little bit where they go back and forth about this briefly, and then Forrest finally says, somewhat impatiently, I think, "You can't hardly lose with this proposition," he said. "Yankees win, you go free that away. Fight with me, and I'll set you free." "And effing we gets killed," Benjamin said, "then you'll be dead." Forrest looked at him, not especially hard. Benjamin held a gaze this time till Forrest told him, "Don't nobody live forever."
You know, when I see that part, that you said that he actually did that, said, told his slaves to set them free if he came to fight with him, and you created the dialogue that happened, obviously, in your head about what that scene was like.
I will say that in this book, I wish I had fun doing Henri. Henri was this type of character that I spent a lot of time learning how to do in those 80 books. Slaves in the American South, I tried real hard. I tried in good faith. Those were episodes that I worked on and reworked a good many times. They're not my favorite, in part because the book requires for those people, or at least some of those people, to feel a sympathy for this, pardon the expression, master. Mm-hmm. And getting myself to believe that that would have actually been the case is not the easiest thing in the world.
If you read works like James McBride's books, The Song Yet Sung, have you read that yet?
I actually reviewed that for the New York Times. I think that's a... Well, that's a really good book, and I also thought a lot about Edward Jones, the known.
Well, that's
world.
What you did review. I remember reading the review. That's right.
Yeah, but both of those, I mean, they constitute a new Jones. I think is
which book is that? You say again?
The Known World by Edward P. Jones.
I have not read that yet.
Oh, you should. You'd love it. It's the first book by Black American about slavery that's not that isn't driven by anger and anger and pain. It's not that there's no anger in it, but there's just a kind of calm distance from the whole situation that gives us this sort of Tolstoyan lapidary quality. It really is an extraordinary book in that regard, and he was a gaucher to do a lecture, and he had a little conversation with students, and he was asked by somebody. I wish I could remember this answer exactly, but mm-hmm. He gets asked this a lot. I think. I mean, there's very sort of even-handed, somewhat sympathetic of portrayal of white people in this book, some of whom are really reprehensibly terrible, mm-hmm. Worse than Bedford Forrest at his worst, and Jones treats them in this kind of calm, you know, dispassionate way, not without sympathy, and so he's always being asked, "How did you do that?" and by implication, "How could you do that?" Uh-huh. He said, "Well, what I used to do is think about how Hitler would have been perceived by his mother."
Whoa. Oh.
So it's just like Columbus discovering America. Ooh. It's very simple once you have the idea.
That statement will make you sit down and think about it.
Nevertheless, well, I think it's a kind of shorthand reply, but he's someone who's changed the nature of what's possible, and I admire that achievement very much. And it was on my mind to try to do something similar in this book. Of course, I'm not coming from the same position. He's a Black person from the heritage of slavery in America. I am a white Southerner from the heritage of owning slaves in America. So we just are not starting on the same square of the board.
But the heritage is connected.
Yeah.
Deeply. let me come back to slavery. I'm going to have to take a detour before I forget. I want to talk about Henri, and I want to talk about, come back to Catherine and Marianne and some other stuff, and wind away into the Klan and Bedford's real role in the Klan, even though that's not in this book. The battle scenes. How did you get to write the battle scenes the way you wrote the battle scenes? It was almost as if you were there in a way. I mean, the visions of Bedford with the gun in one hand and the saber in the other, and in the midst of this battle, and I keep thinking of that scene that where he was surrounded by all these Union troops and alone because his troops didn't go with him, and just the way you describe battle scenes and his love for these animals as well. Well, that's a different thing, but describe these battle scenes.
Well, one of the ways I thought of structuring the book and controlling the length of it at the same time was based on something that Forrest said at the end of the war, which was right as it was coming to an end, wasn't quite over, but he had an encounter with a northern reporter. I think they were on the same train or something. And they talked for some time, and Forrest said, I had 29 horses shot out from under me during this conflict, and every time I killed an enemy in single combat soon thereafter, presumably because losing horses just really put him in a real bad mood. There is this other event which is true and which you see early. It happens at Chickamauga, where Forrest has started a charge and his horse gets shot in the neck in an artery and is spouting blood, and Forrest just sticks his finger in to plug this wound, and the horse unbelievably continues to gallop for another 20 minutes until the need for pursuit is, they overtake the guys, I think, and they stop on top of a ridge looking down on Chattanooga. And at that point, he takes his finger out of the wound and the horse bleeds out and dies. And I thought, that's it. That's the Civil War for Bedford Forrest, that one moment. So I tried to nest all these other battle scenes into that one battle scene as if, through these little gestures of polite surrealism that kind of run the machine of this book. That's the thing that's always happening, and all those other battle scenes are reflections of that.
It's amazing how you did those. I know it's women would enjoy it too, but it's also like a boy thing. I mean, the whole, it's amazingly done. Now, Henri, he never became a slave.
No.
He was found wandering here, coming to America to create this insurrection. But he runs into Nathan Bedford Forrest and these other men and makes it very clear his first words, I'm not a slave.
Right.
He's a really powerful character in this.
Well, Henri, the backstory that I invented for Henri is that he is not 100% black. He's what we call a colored person, or actually homme de couleur in the French system. And they were a class, even after the Haitian Revolution, they were a separate class. So he belongs to them. But Toussaint Louverture did, in fact, have some children who of that racial mixture, not with white women that we know of, but with some very beautiful, charming colored women that he was able to visit in parts of Haiti where his wife did not go. And so there were possibilities there. I gave him a backstory where he gets in trouble in the Haitian army that existed in the 1850s and needs to leave. And he would have logically come to Louisiana, where they speak French and where the colored population had a different kind of status. And there were a lot of free blacks. And then he goes up and down the Mississippi River until he finally hooks up with John Brown. And in the aftermath of Harper's Ferry, he winds up in Kentucky, as indeed some of the Brown escapees did, including one of his sons. And he's really become a barefoot fugitive from that situation at the moment that Forrest, as he in fact did, comes into Kentucky to buy revolvers, or the early revolvers, to equip his cavalrymen, because he had figured out very early that this was going to be a better weapon than the conventional saber.
His character is very interesting. I thought it important to put him in there. I wasn't sure where you were going with this when you first started the novel, but
well, it just gave me this really unlikely point of view for this really kind of unlikely person. It's a marriage of convenience between Ari and Forrest. Why would a guy like that, who was interested in putting an end to slavery, end up fighting for the Confederacy? Well, there were black Confederates, not a whole lot of them, but there were. I mean, there have been books written about them. I don't think it's the most popular subject. Ari's best answer, which he gives he gets challenged about this when other people in Forrest's escort get a better understanding of exactly who he is. Like, they say, well, you know, if you're that interested in killing all the white people, like what happened in Haiti, why are you here with us? And he smiles and says, I get to kill white people every day.
Right.
And that's a facile answer, but it kind of works. I mean, I could imagine that it would have worked for him.
There's a part in this book, and let's read the part we talked about earlier before we went into the studio together, which is the part about where Marianne, the genteel wife of Nathan Bedford Forrest, confronts him about his love affair with one of his slaves, Catherine. And then we'll talk a bit about that. But let's set it up just in terms of what happens in their bedroom.
Well, yeah, this is a scene. I need to probably explain a little bit about this. But
go ahead, please do.
There's shards of evidence that Forrest may have had a relationship and some children with a black woman named Catherine, who he bought 10 or 12 years before the war from a firm. He bought her and her four-month-old child from a firm of slave traders in which he was already a partner. And then she vanishes from the record until after Fort Pillow, when the Northern Press published an article denouncing Forrest for all sorts of, inhumanity. And one of their items was he had this black concubine in the same establishment with his wife, and the two women quarreled a lot, which you could imagine they might have, in fact, done if that was the situation. Those are the only two pieces of evidence for this.
But she becomes central in this book. She's a very important character.
I ran with it. I fictionalized this. So basically this is a guy who's not hugely romantic, but for most of the story, he's in love with two women. Well, that's awkward, as we all know.
Yes.
And so that was in the middle of a boudoir quarrel between him and his wife about this, Forrest feeling very miserably caught out and guilty. There are some things I expected you wouldn't do, she told him. Well, he said, I can't go back and fix that now. No, she said, you can't, but you can get her out of my house and her spawn with her. Forrest raised his head. You want me to sell her down the river? Marianne's bored into him, then lowered. No, I suppose I don't want that. She looked at him more calmly now across the field of crumpled linen. Forrest didn't much believe in God, but what if God had a face like hers? Ashamed for him, sorry for him, not about to move toward him. Do you think it is wrong to use someone and sell her away afterwards? Marianne said. Think twice if you want to throw that up to me. Forrest stood up, feeling one bare foot cold on the floor, unbalanced from the booted one. Use people yourself, then have me sell them. Your precious mama, too. All right, I don't mean nothing against your mama, but there ain't no truth in the way folks think about that around here. find me some other fine lady who looks down her nose at the man sold her the maid that laces her corset and brushes her hair, washes the pea stains out in her drawers. Who do you think picked cotton for them sheets you sleep in, that gown you got on? Yankees ain't no better, no matter what they think. They're in it right up to the neck with the rest of us. It ain't only they brought most of the niggers over here in the first place. Why, they got white children working in them mills up there no better than slaves, and maybe worse, when they ain't got no master charge to feed them. I'm going to skip a little bit, which involves Forrest being reminded of his own daughter and Marianne's daughter, who died as a small child, about the age of one of these.
So sad.
That's real sad. And then they go back to the subject of Catherine the slave mistress. And Forrest says, "You want for me to set her free?" And Marianne, "Would you throw away that much money unless it was over a gaming table?" "It ain't that simple." Forrest began to walk around the foot of the bed toward his wife. "I set people free a time or two. Look at them now. They still ain't free." "Don't touch me," Marianne told him. "Look at me now." Forrest held her eyes. "You don't have to be a slave to think like one. You have to set your own self free." That, I think, is one of my more successful efforts to actually get a grip on those issues.
I mean, you hit a lot of issues in that one little poignant scene. I mean, the complicity of the North in slavery.
Yeah, now, for one thing, and this, you know, some reviewers have pointed out that this is a reflexive piece of defensiveness on the part of the South. It's part of, and it is that, but it's also true.
But it's also true. But it's also true.
So there we are. And I do think, I don't know that Forrest was actually thought in those terms, but it's believable to me that he could and probably would have, because those are very pragmatic terms in which to think. And I think the other thing about him and his, you know, the fact that I see him as being a, you know, fundamentally very decent person who was behind some, I mean, like half a country at the time, struggled for a fundamentally indefensible cause and in ways that are so extreme that they appall us now. I do not think he was a very reflective person.
No.
And it is very easy. It's much easier to accommodate paradoxes in your life if you don't think about them. I think he found it probably pretty easy not to think about them most of the time.
You don't portray him as a reflective person in the book, but I mean, this the whole, the whole issue of Catherine, beyond having a concubine outside his marriage, and it's a concubine that he owned, and owned the children that she had by him, that you have her in some ways being more the seducer than he.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, kind of. I mean, she, however, it is understood, I think, made plain in the book, that her options are extremely limited on account of she's a slave.
Right.
She's a slave of a person that she knows desires her. That's a rather constrained position to be in. What can she do? She does manage to wring as much power from herself out of that situation as anyone could. And that was the part that was interesting to write. And but of course, it's not the same as, you know, as if she was a free woman in the next block in Memphis, and then Forrest had an interest.
So, I really wrestled with this book. I mean, I loved reading it as a novel. It was just really an enjoyable. I mean, I enjoyed wandering through this period and through all this stuff with Nathan Bedford Forrest. And in the back of my head, though, I kept thinking about the massacre of the Black Union troops at Fort Pillow, and the slave trade, and the numbers of slaves he had, and how many lives that he just destroyed in many ways, and the whole Klan thing. It's one of these things you see. What you've done to me here is you made me wrestle with something, because how much I kind of despise that part of the legacy of this man, that just see him as this other part of him as a human being. It's almost like what you said about what Jones said about looking at the slave owners as Hitler would have been seen by his mother.
Well, yeah, I mean that's if you get close enough to anybody, you can't see them in the two dimensional terms that are convenient for hating them. I mean that's just an unfortunate, or maybe a fortunate, fact of human existence. But to start with the Klan, which I think is the most important thing that has stained Forrest's reputation for posterity, he was invited to assume leadership of it around the time it stopped being a bunch of pranksters and vandals and turned into a real terrorist organization, which is what it was. And I think, you know, we need to draw a line between the Reconstruction Klan, which was certainly racist, but there and had a goal of white supremacy, and which, in conjunction with that, was a resistance movement continuing the war on territory which, from the point of view of the people who lived there, was being occupied by hostile military power, at which point it looks, to me at least, a lot more like the PLO or something like that in the 70s and 80s than it looks like the various things called KKK that appeared in the 20th century and that are just pure and simply hate groups, fascist groups. Let's stamp them out. You know, I've militated against them too. Mm-hmm. They're not the same thing. Nor is there any continuity between them. The Reconstruction Klan existed until the Confederates got their voting rights back, and at which point white supremacy they did not instantly disenfranchise the blacks, but it was inevitable from that point on. I mean, they get the white people get voting rights back, then white supremacy is assured.
But they destroyed the kernel of what was could have been an interracial democracy.
You know what? That is going to be something I do in the next 10 years, is actually try to learn about and understand what happened in Reconstruction, if it is humanly possible, which I am not sure. But I don't really know much about that, and I've become interested. Mm-hmm. I do not want to write a sequel to this book that does Forrest and the Klan. No, thank you, I refuse. But I would like to write a novel set in the atmosphere of Reconstruction and try to learn enough about it to do it.
Madison, it's always a joy to read the stuff that you write and to have you in the studio.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, as it always is.
Good to have you here. Madison Smart Bell, latest novel, Devil's Dream, his story of Nathan Bedford Forrest. Read it. Christmas time is a-coming. Good to have you here. Thanks so much.
Wow. Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman, and our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.